Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Reese Shearsmith, whom my North American listeners may recognize from his appearances in Edgar Wright's Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz and the World's End, or from Ben Wheatley's A Field in England and High Rise, or that one episode of Doctor Who. And of course, my UK listeners will know him as a member of the League of Gentlemen, alongside Mark Gatiss and Steve Pemberton. Shearsmith and Pemberton then made the series Psychoville, and their latest collaboration is an anthology show called Inside Number 9, which just finished its third series on BBC Two. Reese picked Theatre of Blood, Douglas Haycock's 1973 tale of horror about a stage actor who returns from the grave to exact a literally Shakespearean vengeance on the critics who failed to fully appreciate his genius. With a bravura performance from Vincent Price as the murderous Edward Lionheart, and a supporting cast loaded with talent that includes Ian Hendry, Jack Hawkins, Michael Horder, and Robert Morley, Coral Brown, Diana Dors, Eric Sykes, Milo O'Shea, and an almost unrecognizable Diana Rigg, this is a film that overflows with baroque delight, and also bloody mayhem, as it must. This is someone else's movie.
Well, this film, like Jaws or King of Comedy, it's one of those films that for me, if it's on late nights anytime, I can't not watch it. You know, you turn it on and you've got to watch it through. And it's been sort of in my life and with me as long as I can remember. I think I probably saw it too early to see it. I think I was probably 9 or 10 or something. Late night on BBC Two when we used to have these horror double bills, where there'd be a Universal and then there'd be a Hammer, yeah. Or a colour film about 1 in the morning.
Oh, so the more scary, really old,
yeah,
classics.
Yeah, yeah, classic pairings. And Theatre of Blood was I think one night in 1970 something. And it just stayed. I remember it was the Arthur Lowe head cutting off, the Cymbeline murder, that was the thing that really stayed with me, and William Michael Horden as well, the first death, which is so grim and real, and he's stabbed, cut to shreds through this sheet of plastic.
Oh, yes.
So grubby and horrible, and it really stayed with me, but it was sort of elegant, so elegantly done. The pairing of the comedy, the sort of intelligence of the Shakespeare, and this sort of segmented portmanteau almost feel of the killings, you know, which it's always appealed to me. The Dr. Fibes films are the same.
I was about to say, I was sure that this preceded the Fibes films,
yeah.
But it actually comes after
that. That's right, yeah. Fibes was 70 or 71.
71 and 72.
Yeah. And this is another one, yeah. It's almost like it's not like a parody of it, but he'd done that sort of film already, Vincent Price. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, and he, of course, is brilliant in it. I mean, and to get to see him do the Shakespeare, where I think he probably, you know, he absolutely relished it. And that cast, I mean, what a cast they... Apparently they all ran round one another, asking, are you doing it? I'll do it then. And so that's how they sort of got the upper echelons of all these great character actors. Yeah. And it's a lovely idea. It's very, very well written. And it's something we've striven for in our work since. I mean, the comedy and the horror, sort of the reality of the horror. I mean, yes, it's all very heightened, but it's all very real. And I think at the heart of it, I absolutely love it because it's exactly how I am Edward Lionheart. So I really feel the passion of his, you know, you're on his side all the time. You want these horrible critics to get their just desserts. And it's so delicious that they, in turn, have these horrible murders that are not sort of, it's quite, people think, I think if you remember or ask people to remember Theatre of Blood, they think it's quite a campy film, and you know, that's attributed to Vincent Price and that and Coral Brown and those people, but ultimately it's very nasty as well. It's a nasty, there's yeah. some really horrible killings in it. I think it's quite daring. It must have been at the time.
Well, yeah, that, I mean, horror removed from its context is always going to be odd,
yeah,
if not necessarily directly translating into camp, but
yeah,
there
yeah.
are things about Theatre of Blood, like the Diana Rigg costumes, the disguises that are, I mean, Jeff Lynn is
yeah.
running around helping Vincent Price kill people.
Yes,
it's very
yes.
distracting.
That's right, yes. It's the meth drinkers themselves are
and
disturbing,
that, yeah.
aren't they? Yeah.
Because I know the meth drinkers from With Null and I. That's where
yes.
that's where I'd heard about the wankers on the meths.
Right, yeah, yeah.
I had no understanding that this was a real thing.
A thing, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And even having seen theater, I'm sure I saw Theater of Blood before I saw Windmill and I still didn't connect the two.
Yeah. Yeah, that pack of hounds that, you know, that are sort of like, you know, they are sort of the baying mob, and how they're disguised in each segment.
Yes, when they're everywhere.
They're everywhere, yeah. And that brilliant bit when they're in the, when Robert Coote goes for his wine tasting as Oliver Larding.
Yeah.
And they're all there sort of all dressed up like toffs and yet completely pissed and drinking their purple drinks. It's horrible. It's sort of so out of control. And yet, you know, they've got this mob mentality. And you see, you know, the way they turn on in the end and kill Diana Rigg and just smash her head in with the Critics Circle Award.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of, you sort of get the feeling that they're really brilliantly cast, each one of them. They all look really great. And there was even... is it Lutty Lemkow? That's his name. You know his face. Yeah, you know his face. He was in a lot. He was in a lot of. I think he's in a Bond film. He's in lots of other stuff. But he crops up in that pack as well.
Yeah. And the woman who choreographed the activity.
Yes,
leads.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. She's there. Yeah, and it's great. I mean, I think it's almost balletic, though, those killings and that, and their that little pack of them is great. And it's a really fascinating time as well. The look of London in the 70s, the start of the National Theatre just coming up in the 70s, and it's a very sort of grim looking film. I mean, quite singular in that all of its location, which I think is interesting. None of it is any sets. It's all filmed in various places. A lot of them have gone now. The Burbage Theatre, where he kills Hector Snipe. The Putney Hippodrome, I think, which is gone now. But beautiful sets, you know, and really, I think, very handsomely filmed for a horror. And Robert Morley are fantastic in the camp role of of Meredith Meridew when he's killed,
yeah,
being made to eat his dogs. But I mean, I think it stayed with me because it's hard to do, and what we've done and tried to do often in our work is that fine line of sort of releasing tension with a laugh, you know, and that I think that's a difficult thing that I think it gets right, and it's properly grim when it's grim, and then it's very funny with these performances. They all have a twinkle in their eye, these people that play in the Critics Circle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very enjoyable to watch, I think.
Yeah, and it lets you root for them. It lets you root for their suffering.
Absolutely,
in a way that maybe it wouldn't if they were sympathetic characters.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great scene when you first see them. Well, it's in the midway through the film. There's something very haunting, very moving about this scene, the way you... Where Ian Henry remembers the day when they'd given the Critics Circle Award not to Vincent Price, and they'd given it to the brilliant young actor William Woodstock, and Price turns up at the drinks afterward in an apartment very much like the one we're in now, and he demands the award because he thinks he should have won it, and they're all back again, and three of them have already died, so it's quite strange to see them all together.
Yeah,
but in that moment you sort of see. Sort of each one in a line reveal their characters. It's really cleverly done. There's, he wants another drink, he's leering at the secretary, and it's very sort of thumbnail sketches of each one of their flaws, but you sort of see it very deftly done. The script is great. It's a very witty script, I think, you know, to incorporate all the Shakespeare.
Yeah.
But I've been obsessed with it forever. I try to find the poster of Lionheart's final season, all the killings in order, you know, that sort of thing. And there's a brilliant bit at the end when he's got Ian Henry and he's doing King Lear and he's going to blind him like Gloucester, and and all of the circle are back, or the meth drinkers are pretending to be the circle with these cardboard cutout faces.
Mm-hmm.
And they're brilliant, and I wish you could get them, you know. Just somebody's, I've got a doll of Lionheart which you can buy, a little dummy, action man dummy, but in this day and age where you can get everything, you would have thought by now someone would have sought out those printed masks, and I would be the first one to purchase them.
It is strange that both Theatre of Blood and the Fibes films have sort of retreated, or receded, I guess.
Yeah.
It's not a kind of horror that is popular anymore.
Yeah.
Although the self-aware aspect of it made me think of Scream a number of times.
Yeah.
Because it's all about the dread of the victim realizing that this is it.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the sort of the glee the killer takes. And now we have a tradition of either faceless silent murderers,
yeah,
or unknowable infestation alien creature things.
Of course, yeah. There's something a bit in them in the sort of episodic nature of it as well, that's a bit Final Destination.
Oh, that's
in
true.
The deaths.
Yeah.
And even Saw in a way, yeah. Where they how is he going to kill this one?
Yeah. You know,
and that's, it's like Acme, isn't it? You, with the Final Destination ones. You, if I asked, I think on Twitter, I said, can someone put one of the Final Destination deaths to Powerhouse, you know, the music from the Acme cartoons, and someone did it, and it fitted perfectly. It was brilliant.
I'm not surprised.
It completely fitted.
I've talked to a few of the people who've made the Final Destination movies, or who've acted in them, rather.
Yeah.
And they said that it basically are like they are these Rube Goldberg machines.
Absolutely,
now,
yeah.
Where you're, or what's the UK equivalent? There's what's his name? The designer of the insanely complex.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I know what you mean. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Rube Goldberg, completely. Yeah, and it's just what elaborate.
Yeah.
And also sort of second-guessing the audience, thinking this is going to happen.
Exactly.
It's been a new thing.
Well, that's like, when they start to
take you by surprise. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. I find the Saw films really frustrating because every new one involves rewriting the old one.
Yes, they're the kind of strange Chinese puzzle boxes, aren't they? You think it's all sort of existential of the other one. Yeah, it's like a Russian doll.
Yeah.
And the first two, I think, were quite clever. I literally lost track. There was one where they were in a house and I was thinking, is this like an annex of all the other Saw films? They're in the same building but not quite. I completely was baffled.
I think in the end it turns out that it's all, I mean, I love the idea that it's all one mall.
Because
3 and 4 I think were the ones that are happening together, and 2 was happening just after,
right?
And it's the big loop, and all you can think of is that for a man with terminal brain cancer, this guy was busy. He's burning the candle at
absolutely
3 ends.
Yes, yeah. But we did something, I mean, not similar, but we had the puzzle when we did Psychover, which is our series sort of inspired by the box set idea of really wanting to write a cliffhanger each week, and then you couldn't wait to watch the next one. It was when I was obsessed with 24 when it was good. And we had the puzzle of writing a Halloween special in the middle of series 1 and 2 without really advancing the plot, because we knew that everything had to be back as it was for the start of series 2. So what do we do with this middle thing that's going to happen to be an hour long? And we hit upon the idea of it being, you watch these three, it was a sort of a portmanteau again. We did 3 stories on Halloween night. These kids were trying to break into the abandoned mental hospital that was in Psychoville. And then we came up with the idea that it was all happening in the run-up to the end of the first series. So it's like we hadn't moved on any. We actually were in...
So it's just parallel.
In parallel, yeah. And we arrived back at the same point, so we hadn't moved on. It was a neat way of not having to advance the plot for that reason. But similar to, I think, what Saw do, isn't it? Where they sort of unravel each time, come out of, you know, you're sort of seeing a bit more of the picture.
Yeah, I think by the end of it, it looks like a Pollock painting.
Yeah, is he still in it? The man, what's he called?
Tobin Bell.
Yeah,
yeah, he died at the end of 3, but he's still around.
How does he manage it?
he's been really open about saying that they just keep asking him. I mean, I interviewed him once.
All right, okay.
It was one of the strangest interviews I've ever done because I couldn't see the film. It was some Comic-Con fan expo thing. He was in town and they were holding a day for a film that wouldn't open for 2 months.
Right.
And probably wasn't done, given how quickly they produced them.
Yeah.
And do you want to talk to Tobin Bell? I'm like, yeah, sure. What can we talk about?
Yeah.
And of course, you can talk about anything because there are, I think this was for 5.
Wow.
And so there were 4 behind it and we just talked about it. And he said, I just assume I'm going to come back to Toronto in the spring and shoot one of these things until they tell me to stop.
Wow. And he's happy to do that.
And he did 2 more.
Wow.
And supposedly in this next one, which I think is called Saw Legacy,
right,
there will be a character returning. And of course, how could it not be him?
Yeah, yeah.
Or in some way.
I saw one when he was absolutely dead and there was a tape recording in his stomach or something.
Yes, that's 4.
Right, okay.
Which I saw here. I saw that in London.
Right,
I was a juror for the London Film Festival. And I had to go. It still remains the most expensive ticket I've ever bought for a movie.
Wow.
So I had to go see it opening night or the Saturday at the midnight show in Leicester Square.
Wow, yeah.
And it was something like £15.
Oh my God.
And it was not worth it.
Yeah.
I saw it with 8 other people who were willing to do that. And they were disappointed. That was the thing. Like, I had to be there.
Yeah, yeah.
They had chosen it.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it?
Yeah. But it does make me think about the impossibility of remaking a Theater of Blood now without some sort of device, because the other thing that's missing from contemporary horror, I think, is the concept of punishment.
Yeah.
And that's what Fibes does. And
absolutely. I mean, revenge is the best plot device, you know, and it's always delicious to see.
Yeah. And insanely worked out.
Yeah, yeah.
Impossible to escape.
Impossible escape, yeah, that's it. And it's always, you know, it's very satisfying to see people being picked off, and especially if they're deserving.
Mm-hmm.
And
as a film critic myself, I find them like, I did find watching it again the other night, I got a little defensive.
I bet you would, yeah.
But, you know, I wrote it off by saying that they're theater critics.
Yes, of course, it's a different world.
They're different. But it is, it's remarkable how the audience, I mean, the audience is never on the side of a critic.
I don't think there's anybody really in it that's without redemption or all the, I mean, you're not expected to be on anyone's side. Perhaps Ian Hendry's character, who's sort of the most, tries to argue the case. He has the voice of the rational. You know, he tries to, as he says of Lionheart, he tried to. He only ever played Shakespeare, and a truly great actor illuminates the present as well as the past. Yeah. He says,
which is
to goad him into the 20th century.
Yeah, it is a beautiful speech. It also completely overstates the responsibility of the critic.
Absolutely,
which is wonderful, because only a filmmaker would think that critics are trying to send them secret messages.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah. But and equally, Price gets the brilliant speech about destroying people's lives, and you can't create yourself, so you have to destroy everyone's lives. Yeah. It's very sort of satisfying to hear that side of it, because you don't really hear it very often, especially in being killed. I was very intrigued when the National did a play version of it.
I heard
2005,
that.
Jim Broadbent was Lionheart.
Oh my God.
And Rachel Sterling played Edwina, daughter of Diana Rigg.
I could watch that.
And it was good. I went to see it. I was so excited to see it. In fact, we were asked to sort of be consultants on it. It was, and we didn't quite ever get involved in it because we weren't fully convinced it would work as a play. And it was good, but it just wasn't the film. You could never do it. The theatre looked brilliant. They'd sort of created a very old, broken down proscenium arch for the National. And it was, and Jim Broadbent was good, but he sort of misfired, I felt, because he played Lionheart as a bad actor. So he was really deliberately sort of mangling the speeches, and it was a little bit, I think Vincent Price got it right, because he did it for real. He tried to do the speeches at the best, and they were very moving, and it was great, but I think he sort of just played a parody of an actor, and it was a bit too, it was an easy sort of choice, I think, to make, and it wasn't quite, didn't quite work. I was interested to see how critics would respond to it if I was reviewing it, thinking, don't dare we not review it, because we're killed. But it was, they slightly changed it. It was more about theatre. It was like reviewers for various newspapers like The Times and The Guardian, and they were being picked off one by one. They killed less people, wasn't it?
Really?
Yeah, but they didn't do the Othello, they got rid of a few of the deaths. But it was fine. It was a slightly unsatisfying evening, I felt.
I would think. I mean, yeah, just, I think the greatest tightrope walk in the film is that we can't tell if Lionheart is terrible or good.
Yeah.
Half the time.
I think that's exactly right, yeah.
It's the, because that in itself is a Hamlet reference, you know.
Yes, yeah.
Mad, but North by Northwest.
Yeah.
And having Price, if nothing else, be delivering when he's doing those speeches.
Yeah.
It's all about how they're received, and they're going to seem terrifying and also moving, the idea that he can work emotion into it, because we ultimately know where he's coming from. Like, he is the wronged, he's lashing out, shall we say.
Yes,
he's deliberately overreacting.
Yeah.
But he is wronged and feels that he is, you know, all the great villains are the ones who think they're right.
Absolutely, yeah. No, he's, you know, you think you are always on his side. Interestingly, we had, it's such, I mean, what's great about that film is that it's so of its time, and that cast are great and all in their prime, you know, even down to Diana Rigg. Diana Dawes having that great part as the cuckolding wife, even though she's not, she's just having a massage. But
that is, again, that's a joke that would have to be very different in the present
day. Yes, yeah, absolutely. But David Warner told me, because we had him in A Number Nine. He was in the League of Gentlemen film as well. But he told me the other day, very casually, it was literally only the other day, he was meant to be the Ian Hendry part. He was offered the parts of Sultry. And it would have been great to have him, because then it would absolutely, you know, him in that part being the young youngest of the critic circle, the Hamlet of his generation, playing that part, but he couldn't do it. He was doing play. So we got Ian Henry, who was also brilliantly iconically 70s as well, and he's great in the part. But I thought, yes, I can see that. And you'd have had David in his prime, and you know, when he was looking like David Warner, you know.
Right. But Ian Henry looks like a critic.
Yes, he does, yeah.
Henry looks like a writer.
He does, yeah.
Slightly unkempt, a little balding.
Yes, he's perfect.
Been there, yeah.
Yeah, no, he's great. But, it's forever endlessly watchable, I think, just for the performances. They're all great in it. It's lovely to see. You know, I like right back to Magnificent Men in the Flying Machines or the, you know, Monte Carlo or Bus, where you have teams of people.
Right.
And that, you know, in a similar way, this film ticks that box for me, that you get these great character actors that you sort of dip in and out of. And each one gets their bit. You know, it's great. I'd love to, if it was, the game is to play it now and think who you'd cast in those parts, isn't it?
Of course. Well, it is a game I play with anything older than the mid-80s.
Yeah, yeah.
Just generally.
And what would it be now?
Who would be your Lionheart? Where would you...
Yeah, I know. It's,
Brenner, obviously.
Yeah.
Well, he's almost a little too young.
Yeah, possibly a little bit too young, yeah. And maybe, like, McKellen would be too old. Yeah.
Mm. Oh, Patrick Stewart.
Yeah, Patrick Stewart would be good. Derek Jacobi, maybe.
He's little, though.
Mm.
Could you believe it, visually?
Yeah, and then you want someone with a bit more clout, don't you? Yeah, it'd be hard. There was talk, I remember hearing that it could have been complete rumour that Robin Williams had some interest in doing it.
Really?
Yeah, in playing, because it's a delicious part to play all those characters, isn't it? When you're doing the Shakespeare. I don't know if that's true or not. And I know Steve Coogan as well had an interest in, had the rights for a bit.
That would make sense.
That would be quite good, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Especially after Dr. Terrible.
Absolutely.
He could pull the period off. And I think you'd have to do it in period. I don't know that you could do it now.
No, it'd be a slightly different thing, wouldn't it?
You wouldn't believe the critics have the power to ruin anyone.
No. It wouldn't be critics in the same way. It would be some blogger, wouldn't it? It'd be somebody online that you track down like a troll.
Yeah, and then you're tilting into Seven territory where everything is Baroque. Although I suppose Saw again, you know, that is the device.
Yeah, yeah.
But the idea of...
Well, everyone's a critic these days.
You'd never run out of bodies, exactly. That could be fun.
Yeah.
But the material, the concept is rock solid.
Yeah. I
mean, it is as old as Shakespeare. Like, the idea
it literally is, yeah. It's great.
Seeking revenge.
Yeah, and they, you know, in its own way, it's in itself, enacting those Shakespeare's being housed in the idea of a series of Shakespearean deaths is in itself Shakespearean.
Exactly.
Yeah. He's a Shakespearean character.
Yeah.
Well, great drama of it.
While I was watching it just this last time, I realized that what's missing is the Tempest.
Yeah.
But he is Prospero.
Yes, and he sort of is.
And the meth drinkers are Caliban, collectively.
Yeah.
And I don't even know that that was intentional. You start to see the patterns.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, when he does Brave New World, is that the Tempest, isn't it? And that's when he...
Just that one line.
I think at least it's a line from it, isn't it?
Yeah,
when he emerges in the mud when you've thought he's died.
Yeah, maybe that's why I made the connection,
perhaps,
too.
Yeah, it could be. But yeah, it's definitely there, isn't it?
Yeah.
But
Michael Fassbender could play Henry's role. So you've got nerd cred for Patrick Stewart and... McKellen and Fassbender in the same film as rivals and
enemies.
Yeah.
That would be great.
It sells itself.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great plot and a great device, and you know what a cast you could create with it. It's sort of on a place, isn't it, to be remade. I'm surprised no one's thought of it.
Yeah.
But you're right, it would need a rethink, I think, how to... couldn't quite be the same thing, because the targets are... Yeah, the parameters have changed, haven't they, now? Everyone is a... Unless it was just NASA. I mean, I remember I've had a conversation with Coogan about it, and he was saying, you know, I want the scene where he's got the critic tied up and he's got his review, and he's saying, you said there are many reasons why this doesn't work. Just give me three and I won't kill you. And he's sort of like literally having the argument with the person trying to justify his words.
Yeah.
And it could be a very funny, very funny scene.
It's like reimagining. You cast the right people.
Yeah.
At this point, Coogan could play the Henry role.
Yeah.
And have the right authority.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, he could. I think he would want to be Lionheart.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I think everybody wants to be Lionheart.
Yeah.
That's the other thing, too.
There's a bit of Lionheart in everyone, I think.
Yeah. For everyone who's ever felt that they were not just given the right consideration or given the appreciation.
Yeah.
It's, Yeah, it's. I'm on his side.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And you're a critic.
I am. But it's the thing that... Yeah, this is my own, obviously, my own drum to beat, but the thing that the film misses is that, you know, hashtag not all critics. We're not...
Yeah, yeah.
We're not the worst people.
Yeah, of course, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I know there are people who do enjoy just going after things.
And, yeah.
And hating, but that's no way to live. Like, if you're actually going
no,
to...
No, exactly, for, yeah. When you think it's mean-spirited or just relentlessly negative, yeah. You think... I think you can sniff that out quite quickly, can't you, in a reviewer.
Yeah.
You think that's not really considered. The worst ones are when you don't with theatre performances, for example, where everyone is laughing and you think, well, this isn't actually true. You know, you think you were not in the... I don't mind it when they say everyone around me was laughing, but I found it this or that, because then you think, well, at least it hasn't worked for you, whatever it is. But you've conceded to the fact that that night everyone seemed to be enjoying it.
Right.
Sort of a skewing of events is when it's not when you think actually not. I suppose it's how it affects the person, isn't it? You must be allowed your own opinion.
Mm-hmm. I've always tried to evaluate things from their chosen footing.
Yeah.
If you want to make a comedy and you have succeeded at that, it doesn't matter if I don't like it. If everybody else did, I'll acknowledge this.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, there has to be some concession, I suppose. No one sets out to make something rubbish, do they?
Yeah. No, I believe that. I think that's actually something people forget.
Yeah. It's easy to forget, I think, in the mix. Because
yeah.
It's, you know, it's very, you can easily be vitriolic about things, but you think, well, they thought they were doing the greatest work, you know.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's a hard thing when when I'm just an actor in someone else's thing, it's such a weight of responsibility taken away, because it's not my thing and I can be the best I can be in it, but that's the end of the matter for me.
Right.
I leave at night and then when someone else is worried about making the day and getting the shots in, and then ultimately when it's presented to the world and you're not responsible, but when it's myself and Steve's thing, like Number Nine, and you have that build up of it daring to present it to the world again, and have we done it again, or have we managed to, because you sort of can only arrive and surprise the first time you do it, and then you're sort of always doing the thing you are known for, potentially. I mean, I think
right.
we try to be very, we're very mindful of repeating ourselves, you know, especially with the Number Nines, which is like, you know, these anthology stories, it's such a high turnover of ideas, potentially. You know, by the end of this fourth series, which we're filming now, there'll be 24 pilots.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of ideas and a lot of worlds to continually create.
Right, well, you're not working in... I mean, it's not sketch comedy where
yeah.
you move on quickly. You're basically shooting a feature every week.
Each week, yeah, and it starts again, it resets. And that in itself is the reason why I think commissioners have found the anthology series, which is a very maligned beast, difficult to countenance, I think, on TV. It's why you don't get them anymore. The received wisdom is no one will watch a thing that ends and then there's no reason to return to it. It's no hook.
Right.
The very thing that they are is the reason why no one likes them. But I think those rules are only in the minds of commissioners. I think people, normal people, just watch a thing and they don't have these things in their head. And if it's good, they will return to it, you know. And Steve and I, anyway, are the thing that's sort of across them, another hook.
Right.
Because our dark-ish sensibility is the thing that I think you would be buying into if you wanted to watch it again the next week. But it is hard, you know, writing one series with a little set of characters that then go over the six, much easier in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know what they're doing, you know who they are. I heard via someone that was on a panel when Number Nine was being judged for an award, that someone from a certain television channel said, the thing about these anthology shows is they're easy. You can just... And it's much harder writing a thing where the characters develop. And I was thinking, you've got no idea. It's the hardest thing in the world, because you are resetting and starting again. You've got to do it again each week. So I want to kill him.
That's good. That's yeah. fair. I think you've earned it. There is that thing, that weird... I mean, they're basically... You can see it as a feature. You can see it as a short film. There are all sorts of ways to contextualize an anthology series that aren't derogatory. And no one seems to have a problem with Black Mirror being Black Mirror.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's Absolutely, that's a great example.
But maybe that's because that's a recognizable brand, and that's the trick. That
yeah, it could be, or maybe it's the tone that, you know, that sort of strange futuristic world that they all sort of inhabit is gets past the idea in people's minds that it is just different every week. That's your hook.
Right.
Ours, are, I mean, number nines are completely different every week. You know, there's always
Even tonally.
Some of them, tonally different. You know, some of them much very silly, and some of them very psychological, and others very, you know, almost like Alan Ayckbourn, very play-like and sort of domestic, and then you get, you know, Pinteresque ones. So we are very happy to complete. And also with the how we make that television programme as well. We've played with the form as well. We tried to do, we did the silent episode where we didn't speak for that week, and we've done one in the fall series. I haven't filmed it yet, but we've done one that plays with the time frame. It starts a bit like the Seinfeld episode. We start at the end and we work back.
Okay. So, and how do you... I mean, with Seinfeld at least, I suppose, you know, Pincher did it with Betrayal. I guess it's not impossible, but you're introducing characters we've never seen before.
Yeah.
With Seinfeld, the joke is in the reactions that we already expect.
Yes, yeah.
How do you... Yeah.
Yeah, well, it was sort of... It was thinking of things that you would... A trick I think we pull a few times is the idea of... You've seen something, you think you know how that could have happened, and then when you see the reveal of how it did happen, when you go back another 10 minutes, it's a surprise. That is where you get your surprise. Okay. You think, oh, that's not how I thought they would get there with that, you know. So, and to do that with this story as well, it was a really complicated one to write, but, you know, we're sort of pushing the boat out with trying to do extraordinary things with this full series. So yeah, it's an enjoyable thing. I mean, who gets to do it? It's like a play box, you know. When we started writing the fall series, we'd written about four or five of them. I think we had one left to do, and we were a bit stumped. We thought, what haven't we done? Because it starts to feel like we've done sort of a facet of everything.
Yeah.
And Steve said, we are in the position of writing anything we want for television. It's quite an amazing thing to me to suddenly realise that, you know, who gets that? And we're so undiluted as well. No one. We don't have a script editor. We write them and they are made. It's an incredible privilege, I think. No one ever really says, well, you can't really do that, or that's a little bit, or you need a... Can this change? Because they're so tightly written and their own thing. To present them to someone and someone go, I don't like that bit. It's like, well, I'm sorry, that's what it is.
Yeah.
You know, you can't really get your claws into it. And I think we've had that for a lot of our careers. And League of Gentlemen was so sure of itself when it arrived, because we'd honed it and worked it on stage for so many years. It was very, it arrived and we hit the ground running, you know. It was very, and that I think is what's wrong with a lot of things. You get that terrible thing of when you look at a new comedy or a new piece of work and you think, that was probably good once, and now they've had a few goes at trying to cater for everyone.
Yeah.
And then catering for no one.
Well, you see things, you see it a mile down off, into just a kind of a monochrome version of themselves.
Yeah.
Where all the colors are shaved off, where the actors have been told not to do a certain thing, and so they're trying so hard not to do that it infects the rest of the performance.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
It's, with the League of Gentlemen, and as with Theatre of Blood, there's this sense that it's going to explode into something absolutely ludicrous at any moment, but it never does.
Yeah.
And the control is what makes it so disturbing.
Absolutely, yeah, I guess
even
so.
In a comic context with the League of Gentlemen, it's something that I had never seen before.
Yes, I mean, one of the most... The League was probably at its best when it was live, I think, because we would have palpable discomfort in the audience, you know, and we preyed on it, and it was great to sort of bring people to the absolute brink of, it was like an endurance test, you know. We have such horrible sketches that became so uncomfortable to watch, and then that turn when you would allow them finally to have the release of laughing, because a punchline would happen, and that was a delicious thing to always play with. And I think we were at our best when those moments were happening. It was slightly... We tried to do it with the TV versions of those sketches, which worked very well live. But there was nothing more sort of powerful than Steve Pemberton playing Pauline to the audience. You know, they certainly were the restart room, and he would play them. You know, he was a great performer, Steve, and those moments were fantastic on stage. But that was what we were trying to do, you know, that thing where you really... can't quite fathom how you arrive at such an extreme situation from something apparently so mundane initially, like a meal in an Indian restaurant, that's a man finding, pulls a gun out to tell them, trying to get a joke right, you know. And I think that was the formula we often would do, you know, that we would do something quite ordinary and we'd take it to the most ridiculous extremes. Doing it with Number Nine, even this series, where the paying of a bill becomes a huge, massive argument, you know, and it is sort of... And I think, you know, you're grounded in something that's very gettable. You know, people have been in the situation of arguing about paying a bill. So if you're in that world, you know it. You've got a hook and a vested sort of... The stakes are higher, aren't they? Because you've had that experience yourself. And I think we strive, however grotesque the characters may be, to have a kernel of truth about them. And I think that's where everything suddenly matters more. And I think the film, is going back to the film, it's sort of like that. In that film, you get... It's very moving, a lot of the film as well. That speech, when he does the Hamlet speech, when he's on the balcony. And his daughter comes in and says, "You're only making them hurt you more." And it's a very moving moment, I think, when he does his "To Be or Not To Be," and they all watch him jump to his death. And that thing where you get sudden pangs at your heart as well, we've tried to do in our work. People were very moved by the episode with Sheridan Smith last season that we did, called The 12 Days of Christine, which is very... I think people were surprised that they felt so... that we managed to upset so many people in a way that was, you know, I don't think people expect us to have heart.
Yeah.
We have a black soul, black piece of coal there instead, like the Grinch. But so it was, I think it was a surprise to people that we could do it, that we did it and that we could do it. So it was a lovely thing to have that, because I think of all of the Number Nines that we've done, that stayed with me people the most, I think. And it's not particularly funny, but it was sort of a good one for doing something that we don't normally do. And I think this, Steve wants to do a romantic comedy one, you know, that would be really... The twist would be that.
Okay, yeah.
It wouldn't be at all horrible. It would be actually quite sweet.
I mean, that's certainly not impossible.
Yeah, no, it's not impossible. And it would be quite interesting to see if we can do it. Our problem is, we try to write obvious comedy, or not obvious comedy, you know, it's not that easy to write any kind of comedy, but to write something broader. Mm. And we always find it's lacking if we don't have some extraordinary dramatic turn or something that just suddenly takes you by surprise on. And I think it's that thing that we've always wanted to do from watching Don't Look Now and Wicker Man and things that completely pull the rug from under you.
Right.
That's when it makes you sit up, isn't it? When you think, I did not expect that. And I think that leaning into something is the thing that we always try to sort of... We're fans of our own thing. And I think we really try to sort of bring an element of... You've really got to sit up and watch this properly. You know, there is comedy and there's programs that you can lean back and it's in the background and the laugh track tells you it's a comedy and it washes over you, but our things are very much more demanding, you know. I think that's just the way that we are with the things that we enjoy.
But that makes it more interesting. I mean,
yeah.
Speaking just as an audience member, I want to be pulled in,
yeah,
rather than told that I don't have to give my full attention to,
yes,
something.
Yeah.
And even with... I mean, there are plenty of comedies that I watch for pleasure, but I know that I'm not being challenged is probably the wrong word, but well, maybe not. There are things that don't require me.
Yeah.
And they'll just function in the background, whatever they're doing.
Yes, exactly. No, it's great when you think, wow, they're really not talking down to us here. You know, we've really got to keep up.
Yeah.
And to dare to have a few moments where you are not told what... You might be a bit confused, you know, that thing that most commissioners and script editors dread, where you are told to recap every 2 minutes in case you might be going to the toilet or you've gone out to make a sandwich and you come back. And you sense literally that you are being retold the whole thing again and again and again. Terrible storytelling.
Now, if you did something that played on that, if you actually use gaps in time...
Yeah.
...to...
That would be quite good.
I wonder if you could pull that off. I wonder if conceptually people would...
It's funny, I mean, I've just done this play, The Dresser, in the West End.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that weird madness of theatre where night upon night you'd have the opportunity of thinking, why, nothing tonight on that bit. And yesterday, through the roof, who are these people, you know, what? that strange, very quick collective decision that an audience creates and have an identity, and you think, I don't understand. It's like they've all whispered, right, we're all going to hate it, Patty.
Yeah.
And they have that, and very quickly you can tell, you know, and it's that permission, it's an early, maybe an early laugh or something that gives everyone relaxes, and you think, oh, we're all right now, and suddenly then it catches fire. Other times it simply doesn't, or they think they really enjoy it at the end. Think, who are you? You've made it so hard all the way through. Now you're clapping. So I wish you'd been with me during it. I would have had such, it'd been so much more easy for me. But and that's a really odd thing to sort of tussle with, the idea that, you know, it's not, is it that delicate? I often think it's not that finite, that a slight thing here or there. I think there's a broad version of everything that sort of lands. Your friends come back afterwards and say it was great, and you think it was an absolutely worst performance ever, and they thought it was brilliant. It's really strange. It's a skewed, obviously a skewed version of events when you're doing it and you're in it, and you can't really tell the wood for the trees.
Yeah.
Well, that thing of, what's his face? Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Larry David.
Going out and just going, no. Walking off again when he looks at the, just to look at the audience and decide, you're not for me, rather the other way around.
Yeah. It's always strange for me to see live theatre because there was a performance of 12 Angry Men about 10 years ago, I think, that I saw, maybe 8, that had Richard Thomas from the Waltons in the lead, and the film is this tense, taut experience, and the play was received as though it was an episode of Friends.
Right.
They were laughing at everything. Because all of the insults in the film, all of the attempts to leverage power, now read like Chandler and Joey.
Right.
And it was bizarre.
Wow.
But it instantly made sense that this is how it was being understood by a contemporary audience. And no one could have predicted that when the play was written.
No.
And the racism didn't land.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're really vague about certain things, and that the play itself is really vague about certain things, didn't work.
Right.
Because now we can talk about all those things, and it was just odd and proper.
Yes,
that
yeah,
things
were
being discussed. Cultures change, texts don't.
Yeah.
The Dresser, I think, is almost preserved because theatre is still theatre.
Yes, yeah. And in a way, I guess it still landed as an idea. I mean, even if it was an old-fashioned thing that we don't get anymore, this idea of the actor-manager, which is, again, like Lionheart, going back to the film.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's of its time, certainly, but it works, that play particularly, because I think it's about people and that strange relationship. No, it's a horrible play. It's quite a funny play. Norman's quite a funny character in it. I played Norman, and Ken Stock was Sir. And it was very, you know, it was a real tour de force for both of us to play those parts. It was great. And but by the end, a brutal, very devastating ending, you know, that whole thing where he realises he's given his life to a man that doesn't particularly care. And that, I think, resonates with a lot of people. There's lots of people, I had lots of letters from people that would say, I'm a carer of my mother, and this relationship, I know it so well. And it was very, I think it was very cathartic for people to see that bottomless pit, that leaky bucket of not being able to, of nothing reciprocated, you know. I think that's a lot of people's lives.
Well, that is the great reveal of The Dresser, too. Like, once you understand what it is,
and
that it isn't even a metaphor, that's simply the relationship, it becomes incredibly moving.
It was funny, Ronald Harwood, who still alive, and he came to the play, he was very complimentary, he liked it. He said, are you getting on with Ken? I said, yeah, we see, because the Normans and the Sirs don't. I thought that's really interesting. He said it's like Salieri and Mozart.
Oh, I suppose.
The actors don't get on. And it's interesting because they're just combative, you know, all the time. And I think I could see how that could happen, you know. But we were all right.
Well, especially if you're doing it every night.
Yeah, you've got to get on. Yeah, it's hard. Theatre's hard like that.
Yeah.
Can't have a war on stage.
No. I'm just thinking about the impossibility of doing Theatre of Blood on stage.
Yeah.
As you're talking about it, it could be. No, I just.
You could. I mean, that national version did attempt it, but it didn't quite do what that film did. I mean, it wasn't funny enough as well, I think, seem to recall. I think it's I think they slightly threw away that brilliant idea of having that, of having 10 of them. I think there's 10 in the critic circle or maybe something like that, but it just wasn't enough killings.
Yeah, you really
did. There is some nice magic tricks. I think they killed the electrocutioner, I remember, was quite good. the head turn into a skeleton. But I'm not sure it ever could match the film for being so. It's kind of perfect. I think you wouldn't want to tamper with it, would you?
Yeah, structurally, I mean, as one of you says on the commentary track, it is. It, there's no fat on it.
Yeah,
it is murder bit.
Yeah,
bit.
It really is, and even I mean, and very judicious use of the ongoing police investigation as well, which is really well done. But and sort of the bit, I think, if you're trying to write it, it's the bit that you'd be least interested in because it's just, you've got to have it in the background, but then they're getting no nearer. But it's done very well. It's woven in and out very, very easily, isn't it? It's sort of there, but not. And they don't advance themselves. And in fact, they're foolish. You know, they're stupid.
Yeah.
In there, it's because great to have Eric Sykes in that part as well.
Yes, and they think they're smarter than him when, in reality, of course, he's playing it.
Yeah, he's one ahead. Yeah.
And the best thing about all of these movies, especially the ones from the late 60s and early 70s, is how gleeful the villainy is. He has not only worked this out, he has worked it out to the point where he can play on Meridew's vanity to put on a cooking show.
Absolutely,
and, outsmart the police simply by clocking someone over the head. I mean, it's really, it's the simple solutions and these elegant flourishes.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And nice little touches with, you know, when he parks Eric Sykes on the railway track and you can hear the train coming game. Sort of so horrible, but it's very funny, blackly comic in the best way, I think.
Yes, I can hear a train. It's definitely a train.
A train. Yeah, it's right.
So weird and formal.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you remade it now, it would have to be a film. It would have to be in period. There's no, I don't think there is a contemporary analog.
It would sort of be based on an idea, wouldn't it? It'd be a vague idea of someone having a beef with people writing bad reviews or online about them, you know. I think you just couldn't quite do it in the same way. Like you say, it doesn't land in the same way, the power of the critic. Maybe it does. I mean, I don't know about, you know, that great bit, isn't there, in Birdman with them?
Ugh.
Lindsay Duncan.
Oh. Don't get me started on Birdman. No, and not just because of the critic stuff.
Yeah, well, no, I'm only thinking about that bit. I like the bit where he sort of confronts her and she's horribly in the bar.
Which
is a sort of faux version of, I don't know whether they have that power anymore on Broadway.
I don't think
they do. Not quite the same thing.
There's an episode of Taxi, of all things, where Jeff Conaway's character is put into a rivalry with a critic
who goes
to see him, and at the end of the episode writes a favorable review of his performance and then tears it up in front of him and says no one's ever going to read that.
Right.
And all you can think of is, but you had to file. You have to write there. You can't. It's a great emotional beat, but it makes no sense in the real world.
Yes, yeah.
And Birdman, to me, every beat of that is the same. And then the scene with Lindsay Duncan, she's actually not wrong.
Yes.
She is saying things that are entirely valid, although she's perceived as the villain
movie. Yes, yeah.
Because Iñárritu has clearly had a speech like this in his head for 10 years.
He wants to vent it, yeah.
Yeah. He clearly wants to do things that no one else has done before, but he doesn't understand that the reason no one has done these things is because they're not necessary.
Right.
Just The Revenant, for example, that could have been an hour shorter.
Yeah.
I mean, it wouldn't have been the same film.
Yeah.
But it would have been the pulp kind of story that it seems to want.
Yeah.
But that's just me being pissy.
Yeah.
But to wrap up, and we've already sort of covered this, but I think it's worth hitting head on. Is there anything of Theater of Blood that you've specifically used or borrowed or stolen or absorbed into?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, there are lines, I believe, that have been left.
I think definitely, yes. The first killing with Michael Horden, when he's trying to get the meth drinkers out of the old tenement building, he's pushing them all with his brolly, and he says, "We'll have no trouble here," which completely is... became Edward from the local shop in Lincoln Gentleman. We used it. Hello, what's going on? We'll have no trouble here. That was stolen. And then in Psychoville, we had the characters of Maureen and David, when David was a sort of would-be serial killer, and his mum was egging him on. And they think that they've killed someone, and they think that there's a set of people that have seen the murder. So they, in turn, start to kill them, try to get rid of the evidence. And one of the women, they... go, played by Janet Mateer, they go and they pretend to be in a beauty salon, and they give her a makeover, and they electrocute her, very much like
Straight Out. Cole.
Yeah, completely. So there's a lot of stealing going on in that, from that film, into homage, as some people would say it, but it's sort of stealing.
But it never goes away, does it? The thing that you love about something,
yeah,
you find ways to celebrate.
Absolutely, yeah, and it's, you know, you don't mind when it comes from a place of love. I think you know, a lot of what we've have done, especially League of Gentlemen, was just, you know, even the hue of some of the coloration of some of the scenes that we did. We know we specifically said we want it to look like Ten Rings and Place, you know, a green hue to this. And that sensibility, especially with Steve Bender, who directed it, who just knew, right, so this is The Shining, or this is Salem's Lot, you know, and we'd say it was like that bit from all the time. And I think we just perpetuate the TV that we enjoyed by trying to make it again.
Yeah. You know,
that's what we're doing now with the number nines. They're like Nigel Neal or Beasts or any of these things that we sort of grew up with. And it's people that finally, in the position of being able to make it, perpetuating it, you know, in keeping the flame alive for people that know and remember.
Yeah. Would you try? Could you do? I was thinking, I mean, if you have license to do anything, could you do Theatre of Blood as a number nine? Is it possible?
Yes. Well, you could do a small... Possibly. And we've done one in the third season. It's the last one that's going to go out, called Private View, and it's about an art gallery, and a set of people are invited to a private view of this art gallery, and they start to get picked off one by one.
Yeah.
So it's a mini Theatre of Blood in a way. And then they went on. It's
right.
One of those things where you think there's something connecting them, but you don't know what it is, and they all seem disparate people, but there's some greater thing that they've all done. So we sort of done a little version of it, but it'd be great to do a full on take of something like that. We teams of people, you know, like Legend of Hell House, when you get these parapsychologists meeting and all at loggerheads. It's great. Me and Mark Gatiss have always wanted to do a haunted house film.
Proper
exactly like that, yeah. If we were ever going to do a film, a League film, I think it would be a full-on horror. And it would be some sort of probably small budget, but you could do it in a reputed haunted house with a team of investigators. Sort of being done to death now. Mm-hmm. But we've talked about it for so many years that it possibly could come around again, you know. You could get it right, it'd be great, wouldn't it?
And that's the title, Done to Death.
Done to Death.
You've got it.
Yes, that's it. Brilliant. Use it.
My thanks to Rhys Shearsmith, who you can and should see in Inside Number 9, the third series of which is newly available on Blu-ray and DVD in the UK on the BBC label. The first series has made it to iTunes in North America, but sadly that's it so far. Oh, and thanks also to Alice Lowe. She knows what she did. You can follow Rhys on Twitter at Rhys Shearsmith, all one word, and you can find Theatre of Blood on Blu-ray and DVD in the UK with a League of Gentlemen commentary track from Arrow Video. In North America, it's available on Blu-ray from Twilight Time and DVD from MGM Home Entertainment. You can also find it on iTunes. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes, that would be very kind of you. Let's try to make it a positive one. Your life may depend on it. Thanks for listening.